Dublin. Welcome to the Quarantine Tapes, a daily podcast from Onassis, LA and Dublin. Hosted by Paul Holdengraber, this series chronicles shifting paradigms in the era of social distancing.
Hello, could I please speak with Wally Sean?
Yes, speaking.
I guess. Wally, this is such a pleasure to have you on the line. Thank you so much for taking the time. Thank you so much for being part of the Quarantine Tapes, which is co-presented by Onassis LA and Dublab. Wally, where do I find you and how have you been spending these last 13 or 14 delirious months?
Well, I'm in New York and, I've been mostly in my apartment. Then I was vaccinated, and I've even gone back to working as an actor since being vaccinated, and I'm doing some things that people do, not that many, but mostly I was inside, and I'm old, obviously, and have bad lungs, and I figured I would be pretty likely to pass away if I got the virus, so I tried to avoid it.
Well, Wally, I'm very happy you took very good care of yourself and stayed inside. In preparing to talk with you today, I did several things. One of them is I read an essay, I must admit, for the first time. I don't know why I waited so long, but I wasn't aware of it until recently, published more than 10 years ago, which is called Why I Call Myself a Socialist. And the last lines of that essay resonated so much with me and spoke so fervently in my mind to this moment. I'm going to read it for the pleasure of reading it to you, and for hopefully the pleasure of hearing how it resonates with you a decade later. Actors understand the infinite vastness hiding inside each human being, the characters not played, the characteristics not revealed. School teachers can see every day that given the chance, the sullen pupil in the back row can sing, dance, juggle, do mathematics, paint, and think. If the play we're watching is an illusion, if the baby who now wears the costume of the hustler, in fact, had the capacity to become a biologist or a doctor, a circus performer, or a poet, or a scholar of ancient Greek, then the division of labor as now practiced is inherently immoral, and we must learn a different way to share out all the work that needs to be done. The costumes are wrong. They have to be discarded. We have to start out naked again and go from there. We have to start out naked from there. And I feel this moment now of this calamity, these words of yours and this paragraph of yours really spoke to me so deeply, Wally.
Thank you. Well, I don't know. I don't see too many signs of society starting again in a classless fashion. I mean, I suppose what that paragraph deals with is the tragedy that most human beings never get even the slightest chance to develop their own abilities and potentialities, and the wonderful things that they might be able to do don't get done, and the fascinating lives that they might have been able to live don't get lived. So that's the class system. I mean, we've divided ourselves into a small group of people who get to have interesting jobs and satisfying work, and others who are kept away from that. The pandemic has brought out the even more basic reality that, you know, some of us get to eat and stay healthy, and most of us are condemned to not eating as we'd like, and to, in this case, death at an early age from a somewhat preventable at this point disease. It's, you know, it's very stark. So obviously, you know, it's at the moment only gotten worse. Although, you know, I suppose as far as from an American point of view, Trump applauded that world of injustice. And in many ways, you know, Joe Biden has showed he would prefer it to be otherwise. I mean, whether he will allow the changes that are really necessary to happen, I don't know, but he shows a friendly predisposition to human beings having a better life, you know.
Allow, and when you said allow, if he allows, I'm also thinking if he can.
Well, no one person can, and a very large proportion of our country is actually passionately opposed to that type of improvement in the life of human beings. You could say violently opposed. Oh, no, I mean, of course, no president, you know, if it would be Bernie Sanders or whoever it would be, they would all have to contend with the fact that a huge proportion of the public doesn't really want to make a better life possible, and in weirdly, even for themselves, in a way.
Two thoughts come to mind. One is a quotation, and one is just a continuation of what we've been talking about, which is, why don't they want that change? And before you answer that question, I remember, Wally, a glorious evening at the New York Public Library where I used to work, where you had an exchange, a conversation, a dialogue with Noam Chomsky. An evening, quite frankly, so splendid I will never forget it in my lifetime. And I read something that Noam said where he said, we shouldn't be looking for heroes. We should be looking for good ideas.
Well, he is very much, not a believer in the worship of individuals or the cult of the personality. And I share that feeling. I mean, of course, we have to have people that we look up to and admire. And he's one of the people that I have looked up to and admired, but partly because of his ideas.
Right.
And he's not a believer, really, in leaders, and neither am I, or in somebody who's going to come and save us. And a president should really be a civil servant who is doing an important job, and nobody should be worshiping him. And if he disappoints us, we shouldn't take it personally. He's not a symbol of everything I admire or believe in, and I shouldn't be disillusioned if he doesn't represent me or do a good job. I should be upset, maybe, because he should do a good job, but I shouldn't look to him for everything. Even people very critical of the government overemphasize the president or the leader. It's unfortunately not just an American tendency. People tend to do that.
That's why I was asking you, why such a large part of the population doesn't wish for things to change, when it's so clear, and I think the pandemic brought it out even more, or I'm not sure it really brought it out even more, it was always there, this deep-rooted level of inequality. But somehow averting our eyes has become slightly harder.
Well, I think that a lot of people in our country, I'm not going to speak for other countries, but I could, if I were more in a wild mood, I'd speak for other countries. But just speaking for our country, there are a lot of people who have lost a lot of what they formerly had. I'm sympathetic to the people who voted for Trump because some of them are the super rich whose, lives have been benefited by Trump, by lower taxes, less regulation, whatever. But most of the people who adored him really are people who had lost some of their hope for a better life for themselves and particularly for their children. And, I'm sympathetic to them. And they felt that any change would probably be to their detriment. They're clinging to what they do have. And, let's say dishonest politicians have convinced them in many cases that any change that would happen would benefit people who are even lower down in the societal circles than they are. I mean, obviously, Trump's supporters are mostly unhappy white people, and they're afraid that if anything changes, the change would simply benefit the people of color who are even poorer than they are. And they're frightened, and they also, in some cases, are involved in looking for someone to blame for the decline in their fortunes. Trump obviously was a magnificent leader in figuring out who to blame and who to be angry at, whether it was Muslims or black people or Mexicans. I mean, basically, he stuck to the darker people and people enjoyed it. The white audience enjoyed it. They gobbled it up and he fed them more of it.
You know, it made me think a little bit of a passion I think you have of magic, but in a way the dark side of magic, right? The sleight of hand magic, the feeling, thinking about T.S. Eliot, where he says we're distracted from distraction by distraction.
Yeah. Well, I do find magic fascinating, and I do think politicians are often masters at making you look in the wrong place while they're doing something. That's their amazing trick. As a child, always, I was fascinated by magic also. And what I've spent my time partly doing in the pandemic has been making podcasts. And yeah, magic in a certain way comes into the story of one of the ones that I've done of plays. I've done two plays that have been split into podcasts.
Tell me a little bit about it. I'm aware that they exist, but I haven't heard them.
Well, they don't exist. I mean, they do exist, but they won't be available to the public for a couple of months. But I've done The Designated Mourner is one play, which is really about, say, a person who compromises and accommodates himself to bad things. And the other one that involves magical elements, you could say, is called Grasses of a Thousand Colors. And Andre Gregory directed both of these things. And we worked for 20 years with a guy called Bruce Odland, a sound genius and composer, who figured out how we could get the original casts together and do these at home. Each person at home, even though some of us, Julie Haggerty and Jennifer Tilly, are in Los Angeles, and the others of us are in New York, but he figured out how we could rehearse together with Andre Gregory and how we could actually make these. And I mean, not with mediocre sound quality, but with sort of amazing sound quality. I've come to be more of a fan of art and magic in my later years, because I think in a better world, that's what people might be preoccupied with, rather than crushing other people or achieving mastery over them or superiority or supremacy. They might read poetry and do magic tricks. Anyway, a couple of months from now, these two plays will be available, but you could listen to them while folding your laundry. That's the amazing thing about podcasts. You don't have to go to a theater. I think it's so thought-provoking.
It really is.
To see these guys about human nature, which we need to understand in order to progress. We need to understand human nature. Very difficult. I mean, psychology is one route into it, but magic and the practice of magic, watching these magic shows, I feel I've learned
so much, huh?
So much about people.
I know so much. And, you know, when I read that paragraph from this essay that I've discovered, it reminded me of that wonderful, since you were mentioning poetry, Wally, that wonderful line of Milos where he says that the purpose of poetry is to remind us how difficult it is to remain one person. For our house is open, there are no keys in the door, and invisible guests come in and out at will.
Wow. Yes, some of those guests are good.
Right. Not all.
But not all. That's a great line.
Isn't it? I mean, you brought about, you know, preparing to talk to you insofar that such a thing is possible, brought about all kinds of lines of yours, your involvement with Brecht, and soon I'd like to talk to you a little bit about Beckett, but also, you know, seeing again. I have twice now in recent times, yesterday and about 3 months ago when I spoke with Ayad Akhtar. I watched again My Dinner with André, and I had such a passion watching it 40 years ago nearly, which ages me fairly much as well, you know, not being any more spring chicken, as it were. But watching it again yesterday and thinking, again. And I imagine it's hard to hear that because one doesn't quite understand what that means, but how much it speaks to this moment, both the existential questions and particularly the questions pertaining not only to money, but to the seeking for comfort, which I think comes in our later years even more so. But how does one balance that desire with, at the same time, ethical concerns of equality?
Well, I haven't succeeded because the desire for comfort is so powerful and secretive. I mean, the desire for comfort doesn't really speak. You just find yourself doing what you are capable of doing to make yourself comfortable. And I, of course, know people who have, you know, set themselves in a different direction. And, you know, and on my travels in my life, I've met people who not only lived in an uncomfortable way in order to serve others, but even risked death. They were so into it. And, you know, God bless them. I idolize those people, but, you know, if you analyze my life so far, you can't put me on that list. It's, I mean, I do think that, what can I say? If you have $100, I would respect you more if you gave away $10 to benefit other people. And I'd admire you even more if you gave away 20 And if you gave away 50 or 80, I'd think even more highly of you, really. I mean, to be honest.
There is comfort on the one hand, and then there is the pursuit of certainty. And when I think about that, Wally, I always think of Buñuel's wonderful line, I'm wondering whether you know it, where he says, I have always been on the side of those who seek truth, but I part ways with them when they think they have found it.
Uh-huh. That seems to be something that I'm not preoccupied by. I mean, to me, it's not difficult. I mean, there are some things that may be puzzling, but suffering is suffering, and I don't think it's that hard to recognize it. And alleviating suffering is also pretty clear. So, I don't know. I don't think I feel exactly the same way as Buñuel, but I don't know, of course, what types of certainty or uncertainty he's talking about.
I think to some extent being sure of oneself.
Yeah.
There's an element of that.
I think feeding the hungry or giving vaccines to people who might otherwise die is kind of an unpuzzling absolute. Yes, of course there are, you know, if someone said to me, well, I would like you to run the New York subway system, my first thought that would come into my head about how to fix the New York subway system would not be very smart. And so, yes, I think I would seek Buñuel's advice and to allow myself to be uncertain and to hear many, many opinions about what should be done. But on the other hand, if somebody said, do you think it should be fixed? I would say pretty certainly, yes. Do you think it could be fixed? Yes.
Do you have ideas how?
No. I picked that example precisely because I have no idea.
But you know that it's possible.
I believe that it's possible. I'm sure that it's possible.
The same way it's possible for us perhaps to live differently.
It is possible. Of course it is. I mean, there have been, you know, many different ways that people have lived over the years. Now, you know, getting into the question of, as we said, in regard to magic shows, human nature, honestly, we don't know the answer to that. I mean, we don't know even how much of our nature is determined by our genes and how much by what happens to us in our lives after we're born. And is there a fundamental and ineradicable madness or evil or desire for power, a desire to destroy that can't be eradicated? I really don't know.
And where we're born, I mean, I think that's so determining. Where we're born in, what kind of a family we're born in, nearly the good fortune or bad fortune we have of where we're born, what we're born into.
God, yes. That's everything. Even as far as luck goes, that's even beyond what class you're born into.
It reminds me of a line that has haunted me for so long, Wally. In Pascal's Pensée, there's a line about war, and it's a very simple line, and it goes something like this, but why are you killing me? And the answer is, but don't you live on the other side of the river?
Yes. The other person says, don't you live on the other side of the river?
Yes. So the question is, but why are you killing me? And the answer to that question is, but don't you live on the other side of the river?
Yeah.
If my information is correct, among the things you're doing during this pandemic, not only these two podcasts you mentioned, which I can't wait to hear, really, maybe while I am ironing or folding the laundry, you're also on a journey with Beckett. Is that correct? You're about to launch a Waiting for Godot any moment now.
Well, I mean, the podcasts are my own writing that I, and productions that I've worked on for 20 years with Andre Gregory. The Waiting for Godot is something that came up, and they asked me to play the part of Lucky,
yeah,
the one who doesn't speak except for one extraordinary long speech. And yes, I agreed to do it. And I did do it, and I have no idea, you know, I'll be looking forward to seeing how it's turned out. Scott Elliott directed it, and I've worked with him many times over the years, and there's Ethan Hawke and John Leguizamo and Tariq Trotter, sometimes known as Black Thought in The Roots. He plays my boss, Pazzo.
And would it be performed? Is it a live performance?
It's a film.
It's a film.
It's a short. It's a film that is going to be on the at least initially it'll be on the website of Scott Elliott's theater called The New Group. And it's a movie.
Is it the first time you play in Waiting for Godot?
Yes. Yeah.
I'm just curious how it resonated. I'm sure you know it well and have read it many times and perhaps seen it many times as well. And I'm wondering at this moment, at this juncture, how it spoke to you. Because Beckett, for me, you know, I think he's another one of these voices like Brecht and others, like Milosz that I read to you a moment ago, who really, really speaks to this moment in a very powerful way. I'm always reminded of this line of his where he says, if we take such dire pains, it is not for the result, but because that is the only way to keep going on this wretched planet.
Well, if you watch the production, you'll see that the interpretation includes our isolated condition as people staying away from other people during the pandemic. I mean, it's very, I don't want to give away
of course not.
The interpretation exactly, but you'll see that it's extremely apropos to this moment. And I feel that Beckett, you know, that he was aware of the dangers to the future of the planet. He was super aware of the possibility that we would destroy the planet. And of course, in the 1950s, people were thinking mainly about nuclear war.
Right.
But I think he was aware of all of it. He was very aware that we might do what we're actually doing right now. We're doing it in a, as you've quoted T.S. Eliot, not with a bang, but a whimper. We're actually doing the thing that people in the 50s, like Beckett, feared, but we're doing it very gradually and silently, and people don't even see it happening.
Again,
some people don't even know that it's happening.
Right, again, a sleight of hand.
You know, yes. Yeah. Well, that's the beautiful thing about what a magician shows, is that things are happening. You think that you're looking right at them.
Yes.
But you're wrong. What you thought was happening is not what really did happen.
And you're wrong again and again and again. That's the most extraordinary part of it. Wally, might I ask you, nearly in closing, to read something, perhaps?
Well, I mean, my play, Grasses of a Thousand Colors, is among many subjects. It is about a terrible illness that sweeps across the land. I mean, I could read a passage, you know, has its relevance to the quarantine tapes. I mean, this is not why you should listen to my play while you're doing laundry, but I could read something from it.
I would love it.
I mean,
I would love it.
it's the play is complicated and the story is ridiculously complicated, but the man who is at the center of the play has a girlfriend who has murdered a cat who is very important in the play. And then she has gone to a place where he lives and sort of destroyed it. I'll read a little of this.
Please do.
And her name is Robin. She reached out for me, held me, and cried for a long time, caressing me sweetly as we lay on the floor, the knife beside us. I felt an impulse to get her out of my house. "Do you want to go get something to eat?" I asked. "Yes, yes." So we walked down the street to the neighborhood cafe where so many years before we'd often found ourselves an early breakfast. But when we got to the cafe, we had a surprise. There was a sign in the window. The place was closed. Yes, our neighborhood cafe, always intelligently run, had come to a logical business decision, which most other similar establishments ended up making just a month or two later. And when I look back on the two of us standing there, what's surprising is that the whole situation was so new at that time and so poorly understood that I didn't have the faintest idea that what was going on with Robin had nothing to do with those new painkillers. A few weeks later, the words "unusual behavior" would be constantly on the lips of every single person fortunate enough not to be behaving unusually themselves. And the phrase "unusual behavior" followed by a short illness and death would suddenly be a formula heard much more frequently than sun followed by clouds and late afternoon showers. I could go on or I could stop.
Please go on.
I'll read the next little bit. Basically, the illness involves, unusual behavior, and it's a stomach illness. Anyway, the night with Robin ended, I thought, in an unexpected way. We went back to the house where she used both her hands in an out of it, but still rather purposeful manner, to remove my trousers and force my member inside her. And then she dressed quickly and asked me to watch her and even to help her as she went through different closets and found piles of old makeup, her own and Cerise's, which, despite my attempts to assist her, she applied with a definite awkwardness, as her coordination was obviously not quite what it should have been. In any event, there was no amount of makeup which could have prevented her face from conveying the message that she was both sick and insane, although she did manage to coax her skin into giving off a sort of metallic sheen, which was odd and fascinating, and in a way alluring, one had to admit.
It's fascinating. I want it all, but I guess I can't have it all here. sadly, but certainly you've given me and given our listeners a taste for it, and I will find a way to find it. It must be.
It's It will appear in a couple of months. And I hope you do listen to it.
I will.
You've discovered the magic of the podcast, the intimacy of it.
The intimacy, I love, Wally, I love the grain of the voice.
Exactly.
The tactile feeling, the fact that I'm not seeing you now, but that actually offers great pleasure in concentration and, the intonation, all of that matters to me greatly. The same way I love the phone, because there's something, the phone has become tremendously exotic, but it leaves room for imagination, and also intonation is like punctuation.
And with a great microphone, it's even more amazing.
Right, it really is.
What is in the human voice. It's simply extraordinary. And I, at the beginning of the pandemic, I, you know, was lured into several Zoom calls.
Yes.
And that at a certain point, I said, I hate this. I want to go back. If I'm going to speak to somebody, I'd like to speak on the telephone. And that's exactly what I've done on the few occasions that I've spoken to any human beings, except for the one who is living with me. I've spoken on the phone because the human voice is so expressive, and you hear so very, very much. And that's, you know, so that's why, I don't know, podcasts are magic. And of course, the portability, the fact that you can listen
anywhere,
you know, with deep concentration, lying down in your bed, or you can listen with slightly less concentration, or maybe you can concentrate well doing your laundry.
That's right.
It's very fascinating.
It is, and there's a tactile quality to it. I mean, you know, and particularly, I think, in this moment when we're so removed from each other out of necessity, it's a way of, it's a way of connecting, which is really interesting to me. And, you know, in closing for real now, sadly, might I say, Wally, I said I did many things to prepare to speak with you in so far that one can, and I reread with great pleasure Night Thoughts, which we spoke about. I think we spoke about it 4 years ago when it more or less came out. And,
yes,
you know, I reread it, and again, those last lines, that last line is so extraordinary, where you say it's perhaps still a possibility that we might be able to stop being murderers. This would be our night, and during this night, we might be able to stop, think and start again in a different way. And that made me think, since we more or less began with Noam Chomsky, to end with him and wonder if there are maybe shards of hope in this moment. Hope is a word I use in a kind of recalcitrant way, but it's kind of unavoidable to at least pay attention to the possibility of some different way of living our lives. And Chomsky says this, which strikes me as so important. He says, optimism is a strategy for making a better future. Because unless you believe that the future can be better, you are unlikely to step up and take responsibility for making it so. And
how great.
Isn't it great?
Gosh, he's made... What a contribution that man has made.
How does that resonate for you?
Well, I go along with it completely. I mean, of course, there can be a better world. And, you know, I feel the same way that a lot of people do, that, what can I say? I was indoors, but I did leap out at least for moments and saw some of the beautiful young people and joined with them very briefly, who were demonstrating, you know, after the death of George Floyd. And there's an amazing generation of amazing group of people in that generation out there, very moving and thrilling. And, you know, they're quite serious about making a better world. And they are aware that it's not easy. And I think they're, in many ways, more realistic than a lot of people in my generation about how difficult it would be to create a better world and what the obstacles specifically are and how great. But I agree with Chomsky that if you, you know, you look at the graphs and the trends, you can become despairing, pessimistic, and therefore, you know, do nothing. And pessimism is undoubtedly leads you to being reactionary and conservative. Obviously, if you think there's nothing that can be done, you're not going to be struggling to try to make a better world. Theoretically, you could struggle and try simply for the sake of it, and that would be sort of an amazing thing to do. But for most people, there must be some feeling that you could succeed. History has so many examples of things going badly, and not an enormous number where stories of things going well. But even Beckett, I think, may have believed. He may have just believed that you should keep struggling simply for the sake of it. But I don't know. The guy risked his neck in the Second World War. He was, in the resistance. I think he probably thought that the war could be won.
Do you know this little text of his called The Expelled?
No.
He says in it, Wally, "And yet my life went on, and even in the way I wanted, up to a point."
Yes. Yeah. Amazing.
Wally, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you so much for taking the time. It's been so long, and it really always is a delight, and I'm really grateful to you, and I'm glad we share this passion for the human voice, as it were, and the human voice as it comes over the telephone.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much. It's so great to talk to you. Wonderful. And you be well.
You too. To be continued.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye for now.
Bye-bye.
To support this show and DubLab's progressive programming, go to dublab.com/support.